Today's podcast brought to you by Elders and Reinagard by Zoetis. Welcome again, folks, wherever you are listening around the world or across Australia. My name is Kerry Lonergan and you are on the grill for Beef Central, the go-to site for all things beef. Our guest today has the most extraordinary list of achievements through a remarkable career and background over just about every aspect of agribusiness. He's had dirt on his hands and shit on his boots, the family farm, and he's hobnob with all the big hitters as a director of the World Farm Organization based in Rome. With a CV of overachievement plus, let's welcome to our Beef Central podcast, Brent Finlay. Brent, hello again and welcome.
Kerry, great to have a chat.
Brent, today's podcast grew out of an almost throwaway line you once proffered in a recent conversation, and you said more or less these words: today's farmers are facing unprecedented pressure because of the complexity of demands on what they have to deal with, especially carbon.
Yes, Kerry. Well, it's a threat and it's also an opportunity. Now, we obviously have to offset, and we increasingly ask why our customers, our consumers, but the companies that we sell our produce to actually verify what our carbon footprint is. And that's going to become more and more intense. I've always said that farmers have got a lot to do. Farming is a full-time job. But when you actually add more complexity, more layers of things that you have to do, the less time we actually spend on farming. And that's what we're good at. And that's our core role. So I'd say the demand for farmers' time, the demand for the speciality that is farming is increasing all the time. And you add to that carbon, what your carbon footprint is in your production system and what you're going to do about that and what your customer requires.
Yes, we might talk further about carbon in a moment, but farmers always had pressure, weather being, of course, omnipresent, too much rain, not enough rain. Are you saying this sort of bureaucratic pressure is harder to bear than those other everyday problems?
Yes, it is. It's so complex. Again, it's those requirements that we have, what we're going to have to report against in our businesses. A lot of farmers, we focus on farming and producing world-class food and fibre, and that's what we do. And on the back of the free trade agreements that were signed 10 years ago, we saw this massive surge in agricultural production in Australia, the opening up new markets, where we've been able to, despite the seasonal pressures, enjoy some of that across agriculture. But then there are more sort of hurdles coming to us all the time, and they appear to be coming quicker and higher for us. Sure, the big businesses, that top 20%, they have the resources to be able to actually build that into their businesses. But where the family farms, the complexity of dealing with what I call is off-farm pressures or off-farm requirements, that all takes time and demand on family farms.
Yes, and I can see another one coming, something called ESG, which you might explain, but it's another piece of paperwork for every farmer.
Yeah, the ESG, particularly for those farmers, a lot of farmers know how to run companies, is reporting against your environmental impact that your farms have, where they are within the landscapes, but it's also around the social impact, is sort of how your employees, how you look after those that work with you and come and work on your farm and through that part of the supply chain that's directly linked to farm gate. And then the G is the governance. It's sort of how you operate your business. It's the structures that your business are within, that they meet sort of the standards that are required of good best practice in business.
Let's go to an issue which I suspect might be related to what you've been talking about, the mental health of rural Australia. Shouldn't we be concerned? How is this impacting possibly on the wider community, especially around regional and rural Australia, these added pressures on farmers and graziers?
Kerry, this is probably the most serious issue that I've seen in my time in Australian agriculture. It's the NFF did a survey report late last year, and I just forget the numbers off the top of my head, but it was frightening, the number of farmers that had contemplated self-harm that came out in that survey. We know on the back of pressures of seasonal pressures of the 18-19 into 20 drought, what happened then. And we saw a clear sign of that last year within the sheep industry and to a lesser extent within the beef industry, when we saw a massive sell-off when the Weather Bureau forecasted a El Nino year, that we were going into a very dry sort of spring, and there was a massive sheep sell-off that we'd never seen before. And a lot of that was down to farmers not wanting to go through that 18-19 again, so they chose to sell down, which crashed the market, and the market's still suffering for that. Again, they're all symptoms of what we're seeing, what we're hearing, and the rooms that I sit in. It is so concerning.
And it kept raining at the time, didn't it?
Well, it did. It flipped over really quickly, and I think the bomb didn't get it completely wrong, because the records show we had a really dry August, September, October last year, and record low measurement of rainfall in a lot of areas. But the fact that it started to rain, and they probably didn't predict, it was going to rain as much as it did where it did, that all played. Farmers take everything that they can see, they hear, they read, they listen to into consideration to manage the risks that they have to manage. And that's how they responded, and because they didn't want to do it again.
It's, the mental health attitude or the mental health part of that must have been enormous, because the memory of that extraordinary drought was fresh in their minds. Suddenly they're told it's going to come again, and they sell, of course, yes.
They did, and Kerry, I look at my own business in 19, at my own farm. Now, the lowest in 140 years of records in our region is sort of 330 millimetres of rain. We had 125 millimetres of rain in 19. Our production system collapsed, our ecosystems collapsed. Yeah. And for a lot of farmers, they see that, they look at that, and then they make decisions based on that or what those predictions are.
Official suicide figures are startling. An average Australian farmer dies by suicide every 10 days. That's startling compared to the wider communities. Absolutely startling.
Every suicide is a total tragedy to the family, the friends, everybody around it. And when I know, and I was at the National Farmers Federation, and sort of seeing numbers like that regularly, it is just so tragic. And part of what I do now with the Future Drought Fund that I chair for the Commonwealth Government is we have a business resilience program that sits within that fund, and part of that, and what it is about, is preparing businesses for drought or even or other climatic sort of extremes conditions. Is knowing what your business is like, knowing how your business is performing, having a really good look at your business, so you're not lying in bed awake at night or whatever it is, thinking about how's my business going to handle this. You actually have a better understanding of your business, and I encourage all farmers, all family members, all farming families, all people who work within farming businesses to look at those programs that are available, to actually participate in those programs, so you actually diminish the amount of worry that you will have about what your business is doing.
Yeah. You've sat and have sat on so many boards. For example, you're president of the NFF, chair of Agforce in Queensland. You're on so many boards here and overseas. But let's talk about drought. You're currently chair of the Commonwealth of Australia Future Drought Fund Steering Committee. What is that? I see it's got $5 billion besides that title. What does it mean? It's in the bank or it's been promised?
Most of it's in the bank. So there's a $5 billion fund. It started out at about $3.5 billion in 2019. It was set up by the Morrison government, and the then Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, rang and asked me if I would actually chair the consultative committee for the Future Drought Fund. One of the questions I asked him was, so what were the plans for this fund? What was the fund going to do? And whether communities were going to be part of this fund, because I don't know of any farmer anywhere in Australia or any grazier anywhere in Australia that doesn't want to be part of a community. And when things get really tough, like drought or extreme flooding or fires or whatever is thrown at us, as farmers, a lot of it's the community and the support of your neighbours that get you through with that. The fund it's all built into legislation that it sits there. By 2028, there will be $5 billion sitting in that fund. I was reappointed by the Albanese government last year to continue to chair the Consultative Committee. The Consultative Committee provides oversight to the Minister and the Department of Agriculture for the $100 million legislative spend that we have to spend every year on building drought resilience across Australia.
So you have $100 million to spend every year, do you?
We have to spend $100 million every year.
Okay. Brent, what's a drought hub?
Drought hub started with an idea that came out of Tasmania where would a farmer or a grazier go to see what a future farm looks like? That was what the concept was. And then that morphed into setting up 8 drought hubs across Australia that are linked to rural, regional universities where possible, to actually operate with farmers, directly with farmers and organisations, whether they're NRM groups, land care groups, farming systems groups. We've seen a lot of farming systems groups connect with these hubs where we can actually get real outcomes in the paddock. And it focuses, spending from the Future Drought Fund, but also leverages funding to be spent on building drought resilience.
So how does a farmer get in touch with his local drought hub where he might put forward a suggestion to do something about the drought in his area?
The idea is how we change things quite often come out of the paddock. And I've always said about the Future Drought Fund, it's a contest of ideas. If someone's got an idea, get in contact with your local drought hub. Generally, if you know people jump onto the internet and Google that, a lot of people will be aware of where they are. There's one in Tasmania, one in southwest Western Australia, one in for all of South Australia, all of Victoria, southern New South Wales, northern New South Wales and southern Queensland are together, tropical North Queensland based out of Cairns and Townsville, and one out of Darwin.
So you contact the drought hub, you put forward an idea, and maybe or maybe not, you might get some money for it. Is that how it works?
Yeah, contact the drought hub, or even just go onto the Federal Department of Agriculture website and work your way through to where the Future Drought Fund is. There's a lot of programs that will be released and have been released, and there's a lot of history about that. There's also a number of grant programs that are there, very diverse. Now we focus on, as I said, on communities. We focus on businesses, and we also focus on the landscapes in which we farm.
Yeah. Time for a break. We'll be back after this short, important message. Breathe easy with Rhinogard, the only single-dose intranasal vaccine for control of IBR in your cattle. Get in control of bovine respiratory disease, that's BRD, before it begins. Just deliver a single intranasal spray of Rhinogard for rapid IBR control and add a single dose of BoviShield MH1 for protection against pneumonia. For rapid protection against MHN IBR in your weaners and pre-feedlot cattle, breathe easy with BovaShield and Rhinogard. Available from your local vet today.
For over 180 years, Elders has proudly been supporting Australian livestock producers. Elders supports your business across the production cycle with more than 350 livestock agents, access to specialist livestock advice and auction services. Draw on our established relationships to buy and sell commercial and stud livestock across domestic and international markets. Enjoy Del Credere guaranteed payments when you sell with Elders. Livestock funding also available, subject to approval. Elders, for Australian agriculture.
You're on The Grill with Beef Central. Our guest today, Brent Finlay. Simple question, Brent, and I hear this so often when I talk to bushies. Why don't we build dams in Australia anymore?
Kerry, in my immediate past, I've been trying to build the first dam on the mainland in Australia for 30 years, one near my hometown of Stanthorpe, and worked on that for 4.5 years. Got the commitment of funding out of the Commonwealth to build it again. Federal state issues. The Queensland government didn't see it as a high priority to build dams. There's a lot of things stacked up against building dams. They are complex infrastructure pieces, but there's got to be a will at all levels of government. And unfortunately, with our election cycles, Kerry, it takes probably 9 years, three terms of a government to build something like a dam. It is very complex. It's frustrating. All the stars have to align and stay aligned to build it. If you get a government that doesn't want to, at state or Commonwealth level, as governments change.
It seems we lack the will across the broad political spectrum. There are certain parties implacably opposed to dams for whatever reasons. Do we simply lack the courage to go ahead and say, let's take these people on and build this dam?
Well, I think at a lot of levels, and dealing with people that have around dam safety and dam safety regulators, what we found was that everybody wants to build the gold standard, the most expensive standard, which is roller compacted concrete. They cost a lot of money. And in Australia, we know that the cost of infrastructure and these big infrastructure projects is just blowing out year on year on year. Does that mean we don't build them? No, we have to build them. And climate change, the forecasting is telling us that we are going in for hotter, drier, but then we have bigger rainfall events. So we've got to catch the water when it's there. So with climate change, we need to build dams. Government and layers of government, it is so complex and really frustrating.
Are we destined to be a country of desalination plants up and down the coastline?
Well, with our growing population and demand for food and food security in the world, we have to find water and use our water better. We still have in some of our catchments, we still have a reasonable amount of water that is available to actually be used, just that the infrastructure is not there to collect it.
And I notice in the Murray-Darling Basin, we've just allocated $200 or $300 million to buy back water rights, which means, of course, they're coming from irrigators, which means, of course, that's $200 or $300 million of irrigation that's not being put on the land, which is not growing food. So what's the end result of that? We've got a good-looking river and no food, or less food, rather.
Well, I think they talk to the people at Moree. When we were doing the drought public consultation back in 2019, we had the whole of the Moree Plains Council came to the public consultation, and one of their biggest issues was 300,000 megalitres of water had been sold out of that catchment, and with that went a lot of people, thousands of people out of the town. So there's massive social impact as well as production impact.
Yeah. Now, let's change the subject. We could talk about water all day because I think it's one of the most important issues facing Australia. And I bet I thought that for 25 years and nothing's new. Now, Brent, you have wind turbines on your property. How's that experience?
Yes, Kerry. We're part of a wind farm called the McIntyre Wind Farm, which is currently the largest wind farm in the Southern Hemisphere under construction. It's interesting, 2011... someone drove up our driveway and wanted to talk about wind farms. And at that stage, I was at Agforce in Queensland, and we were dealing with an out-of-control gas industry, and we were just trying to put in conduct and compensation arrangements within that industry to try to bring some rules and regulations around it. And so we had this wind farm arrived, and as of today, I think the second turbine's being completed on my farm. So this just shows how long it takes for these even wind farm projects, renewable projects, to go from when the thought is there through to developing it, through to capitalising it, then through to building it.
Let me get back to it briefly again because, it's another favourite topic. There's a feeling, I think, out there in farming and grazing country that governments and bureaucrats are making it harder and harder to farm. More rules for this, more rules for that. What do these rules do for the price of food and fibre?
Well, I'm not too sure about the price of food and fibre. Certainly the cost of producing food and fibre, Kerry, is where the pressure is. And that's what our earlier conversation about what's coming at agriculture. Some of our sectors are still quite profitable, but a lot of the sectors, with our families being traditionally in wool, it's a commodity that we all know the ups and downs of the wool industry. But I just finished my shearing. It cost me over $10 to shear a sheep. No, it's hard work. We understand all that, but just those labour costs and getting labour to do that. And I'm hearing the same in horticulture. Finding people to work in horticulture, but also the returns, particularly where you're captured by supermarkets. We're hearing a lot about horticulture when you start to see some of the big horticulture businesses up for sale, generally that's telling you that something's going on price-wise. I know when we talked about the excellent trade agreements that were done by Andrew Robb as the trade minister, and it was an amazing time for Australian agriculture in the Abbott government when we the China Free Trade Agreement, the Japanese EPA, the Economic Partnership Agreement we did, Korea as well. They set a really high bar for what we were, but not every commodity, every product in Australia could access those international markets. Some are still confined to dealing with the supermarkets within yes. Australia, and that's tough. If you're captured and you have limited market diversity or market access, and that or other income streams, it's tough.
Yes, we could talk for 30 minutes on labour problems in the farming communities yep. around the world. I suspect they're not unique to Australia. Now, can I mention farmers in Europe? They're getting out there, revolting against government or, in particular, EU regulation. Can you see Aussie farmers doing the same thing?
It takes a lot to annoy a farmer enough to get them to go off farm and protest. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't do it. One of the things I spoke recently about is that the unity in farmers and farmers needing to work together, and it's the same as with renewables, that farmers need to come together to actually, one is understand what that industry is that's coming into our landscapes, but also if you work together, you will get a far better outcome. And I know, having been in the agricultural representation and a lot of people have opted out over that over the years, but you need someone there fighting for you, because quite often governments have no understanding. People who develop policy within governments have very little understanding of what it actually means to the person in the paddock.
I remember seeing a picture on television not so long ago where the French farmers had dropped 10 or 20 tonnes of wheat on the Champs-Élysées, which is the main street of Paris, virtually, in the heart of Paris. Yeah. And I don't know, you couldn't do it in Canberra, they just treat it as another roundabout, but what if you dropped it in Collins Street or Pitt Street in Sydney, what the reaction would be?
I can imagine, but it is, but part of it is being there before those decisions are made about the policies that impact us. So being there and advocating on behalf of agriculture to not always negate totally the impact of things, but to fight off them, lessen it. And I know when I was at the NFF, some of the victories that we had behind the closed doors with government, they're the sweetest victories of all to have. But you've got to be there. You've got to be there every day, and you've got to have smart people that are working for agriculture to try and head off a lot of these ill-conceived, even ridiculous ideas. And people just think that agriculture will keep farming. Farmers will keep farming. Doesn't matter what you throw at them, they will keep farming. They will keep producing because they love doing it. And yes, they do love doing it. And they love the land on which they live and work.
We deserve better, I think. I just want to make the point, agriculture is declining. It's less, I think, than 3% of GDP, but it is 20% or makes up 20% of all exports. And in fact, if you join in the minerals, which is mostly mined from regional and rural Australia, you get 55% of our exports coming from minerals. So in a good year, 25%. So that's 80% of our export income coming from the bush. Surely the bush or agriculture deserves better from Canberra.
It's Canberra, but it's also Kerry, the state governments as well, because so much of what we have to deal with, all our water issues, our land management issues, so a lot of these are state-based issues that are impacted by like land tenure and that. They're state issues. And again, what I said about the dams is very rarely do they line up together. Our federated model creates so much cost for us. But also creates difficulties with policy. Yeah. I mean, what you can legally do under state legislation, and I think of EPBC with this Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, the big mouthful that was brought in by the Howard government at the time. Now, what you can do legally at a state level can be illegal at a Commonwealth level.
But you have been on and are on so many boards. Do you still feel rewarded after putting in so many hours, weeks reading board papers?
Good board papers are okay to read, Kerry. Some of the ones that aren't so good or whatever it is, they're a long slog. But again, the devil is in the detail. Yeah. And and someone's got to read all this stuff, and someone's got to have an idea. And over the years, I've fielded various phone calls from ministers saying, "I believe the industry is happy to support this," when our position is completely the opposite. These things happen, so you've got to be across your brief. It's been an incredible experience for me to represent farmers when I was doing that, and a complete honour. But there's also a massive responsibility that comes with it.
You ever dozed off at a board meeting? It's a secret. I won't tell you.
actually, no. I'm actually pretty good. But, over the years, working with people that have been that come in from their farm into meetings, whether it was at a state level or in Canberra, and they're working really hard at home to find that day to actually do their put on a different shirt and sit in a boardroom meeting. Yeah. And if it gets a bit slow, you see a few of them sort of have a bit of a nod. But you got to keep the meetings rolling, make the decisions, do what you've got to do, make sure everyone's read all their papers and understands the issues.
Brent Finlay, or Dr. Brent Finlay, because I see among your awards an honorary doctorate, Dr. Finlay. You have made and continue to make an outstanding contribution to rural Australia. Thank you for joining us on The Grill for Beef Central.
Kerry, great to have a chat.
And thank you for joining us. Until next time, I'm Kerry Lonigan. This has been The Weekly Grill, brought to you by Elders and Rhinogard by Zoetis.